This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Our guest today is Amanda Rodewall, Garvin Professor and Senior Director of the Center for Avian Population Studies at Cornell University's University Lab of Ornithology. It's in the Department of Natural Resources and Environment. She obtained her BS in Wildlife Biology at the University of Montana. She worked for several months as a biological technician at Glacier National Park and for 2 summers in Libby Kootenai National Forest Area for the Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. A couple of years ago, she was a speaker at the Raptor Festival at Bridger Bowl, north of Bozeman. So welcome, Amanda. It's good to be talking with you. We haven't done an interview on birds for quite a while, so this is going to be interesting. So
thanks so much for having me, Jay. It's really great to be connecting back with Montana folks again, having started out my career there.
So how long have you been on the staff at Cornell?
I joined Cornell in 2013, and prior to that had been faculty at The Ohio State University since 2000.
But you haven't lost your love for Montana, I gather.
No, I have not. It's such a special place. Really special people, too.
So you were the lead for the State of the Birds report that was recently issued by a collaboration of groups. Is that right?
Yeah, so I co-chaired the science committee with Ken Rosenberg, who's also at the Lab of Ornithology, Michael Brazier, who's with Ducks Unlimited. But really, it's a team effort. You know, we had tons of different NGOs and agency partners who participated in the process.
Was this a nationwide study? What was the spread?
Yeah, so this is the report focused on the state of the birds within the United States. And we focused mostly on the continental U.S. as opposed to Hawaii, because Hawaii is, a lot of other issues, facing it specifically. So, yeah, we were looking at, really how are bird populations doing across the country, particularly over the period since about 1970.
And how did you put it together? How did you collect information to assemble this report?
Well, we relied on actually data that had been gathered by private citizens across the country since the late 1960s, and that's the Breeding Birds Survey, and that's been run by the USGS. And so volunteers go out and conduct bird surveys on specific routes using a structured protocol every year. Now, that has been the best source of long-term data that we have on bird populations across the country. Now, what it was showing is pretty staggering.
I gather there were a number of organizations that were involved, because Audubon does an annual Christmas bird count and other bird counts through the year.
Right, and those, and Christmas bird counts are a bit different, right? So those are occurring during the non-breeding season, in December, but they're not as structured in terms of the time and the effort that's done. You have teams that are participating in that. But breeding bird survey data, that is with a federally run program that provides that source of information.
So what I saw from the summary of the study was that there are 2 major trends: increased populations of water birds and ducks, is that right? Waterfowl?
Right. So we have, so if you look at the trends, geese, ducks, and about a third of water birds have been increasing since 1970. And for the ducks and geese, those some in some cases are just going, or I guess geese and swans are the ones that are going up the most. Which is both a success story, but also, as we know, can cause some problems in areas because they're, they can become, kind of pests and damage crop or other habitats. But still, they've rebounded dabbling ducks, diving ducks as a whole, and yeah, water birds have all increased. Unfortunately, that's not the same as we see for these other groups, though.
Yeah, the other trend was that there are decreased populations of birds in forests, grasslands, desert shores, oceans.
Yeah, and some of those are quite alarming.
Uh-huh.
And when we look across it, you know, we're seeing, in fact, that over half of the species that breed in the U.S., so about 57%, you know, are showing declines on the basis of those long-term survey data. And what's really sobering is that, again, with the exception of the geese and, you know, waterfowl, and water birds, you know, we're finding that those declines really span all habitats and different groups of birds.
There was a 2019 study that found that 3 billion birds were lost in the last 50 years. That's pretty, quite a profound finding.
It is. That really sounded the alarm. And, you know, I have to say that surprised even many of us that are working in bird conservation and ecology. So, again, to put that just in different numbers, you know, 3 billion breeding birds is equivalent to just over 1 in 4 birds, individual birds that have been lost in U.S. and Canada in the last 50 years. And so, you know, that's enormous. And one of the take-home messages from, we call it the 3 billion bird paper, and this is the one that was published in Science magazine in 2019, you know, so one of the really staggering findings is that we're not seeing declines only happening in the species we'd ordinarily consider to be, you know, sensitive or, you know, of conservation concern. We're seeing these declines in some species that we would ordinarily regard as common. You know, so in much in the same way, you know, if we think about like the passenger pigeon, most people know about that, right?
Right.
Most abundant vertebrate in the planet.
Mm.
And then it was gone. It was extinct in no time at all, right? Today, we've in some ways forgotten that. You know, we see birds like American robin, you know, or even like invasive species like half sparrow, and you think, goodness, yeah, they're going to be around forever. They're going to be a problem forever. No, we're actually seeing pretty large declines in some of those. You know, so it is a wake-up call, I think, in many ways.
What species have gone extinct in the last 50 years?
So we haven't seen all that many extinctions, you know, relative to the number of species declining. If we look at extinctions, you know, we have, you know, many different Hawaiian species have gone extinct, and many are right on the brink with only a few. Other ones that people have probably heard about, ivory-billed woodpecker, you know, that was one that was actually just formally declared extinct by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and I think last year. There's species like Bachman's sparrow, Labrador duck. There have been a number of species, but when we look really over the history within North America, a lot of the extinctions were driven by overharvest, like great auk, you know, is an example of that as well. Heath hen, another like overharvest, and some by some habitat loss as well. Passenger pigeon, of course, was market hunting combined with habitat loss. So there are a number of different factors that have affected those prior extinctions. But what we're concerned with now is that there's a group of species that we highlighted within the state of the birds that we call a tipping point species. And these have been identified by a group of scientists who came together and identified, well, what are the birds that have lost over half of their population size since 1970? So in the last 50 years, they've lost half and are on track to lose half again for their populations over the next 50 years. And those species, these tipping point species that we're highlighting in the report, those are the ones that are likely to require listing under Endangered Species Act. Those are the species that really do face, you know, a serious risk of extinction. And if we, you know, think about it, like shorebirds, about a third of shorebird species are considered these tipping point species. One third. One quarter of our grassland birds are considered tipping point species. And so in the State of the Birds report, we actually go through each of those kind of habitats, and we identify, you know, what are the tipping point species within that?
So there are a number of birds that are on the endangered species list. What birds have you found should be on the endangered species list and aren't yet on it?
Well, that wasn't the purpose of our report, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has a very rigorous process for evaluating which species require listing and soliciting public comments and input from a wide variety of different, you know, organizations and agencies. So that was not the purpose of this report, and
okay.
That's not something that I would comment on.
I
have, you know, a lot of faith, a lot of trust
sure.
in the sound judgment of the agencies who determine that. But again, so what we really looked at was just in terms of population trends, you know, what are the species that if we're just looking at the nature of the decline,
uh-huh.
the severity, the duration, those tipping point species are the ones that we feel are most likely to require protection. And if you look through, so the species most at risk generally, again, grassland birds, shorebirds, sea ducks, those are all species that have lost, you know, about a third, or an average population decline of about a third. And, you know, kind of close behind with arid land birds, eastern forest birds, you know, they've lost about a quarter, more or less. So, you know, these are, you know, again, they're, you know, these are signals about what's happening out there in these habitats. Because most of these declines really still do stem from habitat loss and degradation, you know, and that could be due to land conversion for urbanization or agriculture, agricultural intensification. It could be due to things in some cases like the use of pesticide or other pollutants or introduced species. And climate change, of course, too, can add to and exacerbate some of those, you know, the threats that species are facing as well. In turn, and in some cases can be one of the main contributors. But, you know, when we're looking across, like, what's happening in these habitats, you know, I think most of the trends we're seeing are reflecting the choices that we're making when we're managing the land.
What are the projections for the future? Are you pessimistic or are there signs for optimism?
Well, I guess it's sort of like anything. It's a bit mixed. Right. So if we look at the trends, they're really sobering, like we said. So without any action, we should expect that these declines will continue and likely become more severe. Right. But I do have hope. And the reason I have hope is that, you know, if we look now across all of the different challenges we're facing in the world and in our country, and whether we're concerned about climate change or drought or fire or intensifying storms or, you know, food security, you know, resilience of rural communities and their livelihoods, no matter what we're really focused on, we're seeing more and more that the solutions are converging and pointing to the choices we make about how we protect the environment, right? Because in the end, if conditions aren't healthy for birds, if conditions aren't healthy for other species, they're not going to be healthy for humans either, not over the long term. So I think that I have hope, I guess in some ways, my hope does not stem from convincing everybody to care about bird conservation specifically, because I don't think that's needed. I think that a lot of the choices we need to make as Americans and as a global community in our own self-interest for health, for well-being, for economic productivity, you know, for all of those things. If we just care our own self-interest, thinking about what's the world we want our grandchildren and great-grandchildren to have, those choices, in many cases, are the same choices or the same actions that we need to do to conserve birds. And so that convergence is why I really have hope. And I think that people are ready to act.
So is there an intrinsic value for birds apart from what it means for us?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, for many people there is. I mean, there is, you know, I think the intrinsic value does get into personal values,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think to a large extent, right? And we know that, you know, for some people, there can be value that they get from seeing different tsetses, you know, the enjoyment, the aesthetic value. There's also value just in knowing species are out there. You know, people care about polar bears, even though most of us are never going to see them, right? And so that sort of value. And then for, you know, for others, it's just that every species has a right to exist. But I do think, and I, you know, again, just circling back, even though there is that intrinsic, so many reasons to protect birds just because of the roles they play in our environment that protect other things that we care about, right? Like eating the insects that are damaging crops or causing outbreaks in our forests or dispersing seeds or removing waste or supporting nutrient cycles that are keeping our land productive. I mean, just as one example, a new study showed that like vultures around the world prevent tens of millions of metric tons of carbon emissions every year. Vultures, right? And then, too, like the economic contribution of birds, you know, by way of hunting and recreation, Americans spend $140 billion every year on wildlife-focused recreation, and most of that is focused on birds. So while there is that intrinsic value, I think, you know, we all value different things for different reasons, and that's okay. You know, again, it's like there's so much value on the intrinsic and on the more instrumental, you know, side of things. It just makes a really compelling case for, again, why some of these actions have so many broad benefits.
So the report says that conservation must be stepped up, and it talks about proactive conservation. What does that mean?
Yeah, so, well, proactive conservation means, like, basically not waiting to the last minute. Right? If we put off conservation, if we wait till species have declined to the point where they require listing from the Endangered Species Act, we know from experience that it's going to be more difficult, less effective, way more costly, and way more disruptive to human activities if we're going to serve them, right? No one wants species to be listed by Endangered Species Act. It's kind of like the, you know, the saying, it's like a pinch of prevention is worth a pound of cure, you know, or an ounce of prevention or however that goes, right? But you know what I mean. And so that's what we're talking about with proactive conservation.
Uh-huh.
And I think, like, with stepping it up, right, it's just that we need to do more in some cases. That's no doubt true. But we need to do it better. Sometimes better means that, you know, we're not using, like, the broad brush approaches to conservation. We don't have to do that in many cases. We can focus on the most important problems, you know, and the right places at the right time. So that's kind of what we mean by stepping it up.
And is that what you mean by surgical precision?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And so that surgical precision means that, you know, if we can identify, well, let's say there might be a species that's declining broadly. You know, if we look at a national population trend, but if we drill down a bit, we might find that there are some specific regions where the problem is really limited. You know, can we focus the management, you know, the practices, those interventions on those places in order to get the results we need? You know, because conservation costs money, mm-hmm. disrupts in some cases, you know, people's other activities they want to do. So the more precise we can be, the more likely we're going to have these win-win outcomes. And it's really about, in some ways you could think of it as getting the biggest bang for our buck, mm-hmm. right? We can be more precise and more strategic, and that's going to make it more effective, more cost efficient, and more accommodating of other activities that are critical for people's livelihoods and their communities and local economies. And so that happens not only over space, but over time. Like, we can think of migratory birds, right? There's a, you know, great example of a program called Bird Returns that's been run in the Central Valley of California. And this is run by the Nature Conservancy with, like, California Audubon and Point Blue, I think, Bird Observatory. And they've been working together And using in the Cornell lab has been the science partner providing much of the data that they need. But the problem is you have all these, you know, all these waterfowl, shorebirds are moving through the Central Valley where it's all rice fields. Right? And they're moving through at a time when they need water on the landscape. The birds need it. The problem is that, geez, for the best outcomes for rice, farmers want to draw down the water at those periods. So what they're able to do now is say, okay, we don't need to buy the land to take land out of production entirely. What we need to do is figure out where are the most important fields in that landscape. Ask farmers, okay, how much would it cost you? How much would you need to be paid, you know, to compensate you if you kept water on your landscape for 5 more weeks during the year?
Uh-huh.
The farmers can participate or not, and they get to set the price. The power's with the farmers. But then with the data behind it, the Nature Conservancy could decide, again, where do you get the biggest bang for your buck when you're actually making those payments? And they've seen phenomenal responses in terms of and numbers of shorebirds and waterbirds and waterfowl out there. And again, that's that precision conservation. It's disrupted the fewest people. It's compensated those that are participating, and it's really effective, way more effective than trying to pull land completely out of production, because that isn't necessary, right? So those are the kind of creative win-win solutions that we need. And for those, too, that's what we require science for, right? We require a lot of information in order to really figure out those kinds of solutions. And actually, we just at the Cornell Lab last week released new product from eBird, which is a global project, citizen science project we run, where people can submit observations and checklists of birds around the world. And this if you go to eBird website, it's phenomenal. The information, weekly abundances of bird species, you know, around the world. But we just released now population trends. And so across the whole U.S., you know, we can, across really all North America, we can see in 27 square kilometer little areas what the population trend is, you know, so how populations have declined or increased since 2007. And so that kind of view, that kind of information that people are just producing with us, it's a collaborative endeavor, you know, that's the sort of thing that can fuel these kinds of creative approaches that I've been talking about. So it's a really exciting time for conservation right now.
So you specifically talked about California for grasslands conservation. Is that being done all across the country?
Yeah, there are a lot of efforts for grasslands. So people are focusing on them. And the drivers, it's interesting because it's, in cases, it's conservation for wildlife. In some cases, it's for, you know, cultural value. People want to keep farmland, right? They want to keep those open spaces and not see everything turn into development. In other cases, these efforts are to ensure the productivity of the land. So there are many government and NGO and private groups that are working on grassland conservation. One, there's actually been a bill that was introduced to the Senate in July called the North American Grassland Conservation Act. And that's modeled after what we call NACA, or the North American Wetlands Conservation Act, that was, you know, incredibly helpful in protecting waterfowl and geese. And so if it's passed, it's now in committee in the Senate, you know, that would provide a grant program that would help fund projects that local, state, tribal, you know, regional groups can implement. It's all voluntary, incentive-based sort of action. And there are other examples, like, well, right there in Bozeman, you know, near you, there's an office, World Wildlife Fund. They have a sustainable ranching initiative that they run, where they're working with partners, you know, whether it's industry, landowners, NGOs, agencies, to develop with them land management strategies and incentives and provide technical expertise and help secure funding. Audubon has a conservation ranching initiative where they, if you have good stewardship of grasslands, you get a certification label for beef products that you get a higher price. And even Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks has a working grasslands initiative that, again, is looking for voluntary ways to implement voluntary incentive-based programs for landowners. So there's a lot happening out there. And I'll just add one thing, too. There's a really exciting piece of legislation that hopefully will be passed this month in the lame duck session of Congress. Funny talking about birds, but it's called Recovering America's Wildlife Act. This is really a generational opportunity we have for conservation. It's a bipartisan bill that will provide almost $1.5 billion in funding for state wildlife agencies and tribal nations to implement their wildlife action plans. And so just as to compare, right now, state and tribal governments only have about $65 million that are available for the country. This would be $1.4 billion, right? So this is enormous. So we can, right. So there is a lot of opportunity that we have now, to implement conservation. We know that we need funding realistically in order to do that. Even for voluntary, incentive-based conservation, the money has to come from somewhere. So for grasslands, and there's a lot happening right now, there and in other habitats that really provides us with a lot of hope.
So you talked about working with communities. Is that what you were just recently describing?
Yeah, absolutely. We need to work with communities because, this isn't, we've learned, right, sort of top-down, conservation isn't going to be effective in most situations, and especially in some habitats, right, some ecosystems like grassland, it's private land, right? So we have to work with partners. We need to work with the people and the stakeholders and who care about or depend upon or are affected by the resource and the conservation action. And so that is a trend that you see really broadly in the way conservation is approached. And incentives are a really common tool now that are being used to encourage action, right, and the adoption of specific conservation actions. So, right, like payments to farmers for CFP contracts,
right,
conservation reserve programs, or tax relief for easements, right, and those are great because they also better distribute the real cost of conservation, so it's not falling on any one single person's back or single group's back, and those are best developed with the communities and that they're affecting to make sure they're relevant and desirable and sort of meaningful options for them.
Well, Amanda, a half hour goes by quickly, so I want to thank you very much for this informative session. Thank you again.
Thanks so much for having me, Jay. It's been really fun, to talk with you, and I'll look forward to the next time.
And the online contacts are what?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Well, what are the online contacts that people can get more information?
Oh, sure, yeah. So if you just were to, Google State of the Birds 2022, that will bring you to a website where you can download the report. And you can also access, and look for yourself at whatever species you care about if you go to eBird. If you just Google eBird or the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, you can actually go in and see population trends more recently for species across the U.S.
Very good. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Amanda. I really appreciate it. Our guest today.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Our guest today has been Amanda Rodewald, Garvan Professor and Senior Director of the Center for Avian Population Studies at Cornell University. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to js-wilderness.com and see additional features of our website. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Shell.